Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. It is a high pleasure and great privilege to welcome for the first time to our microphones a woman who has distinguished herself in uniform of the United States Air Force specifically, and now in the halls of the United States Congress. She is Representative Martha McSally. She represents today the people of the 2nd Congressional District of Arizona. She is also a retired colonel in the United States Air Force, who has distinguished herself, as I say, in a number of ways, notably flying the first combat mission for a female and also commanding for the first time as a female the squadron of the Air Force involved in combat operations, an A-10 instructor pilot, among other things. Congresswoman, it is great to have you with us. Thank you for all of that service to our country and that you're providing at the moment. Welcome aboard.
Oh, absolutely. Thanks for having me on, Frank.
Let me just talk about a couple of things that are high policy that I know you're also following closely and are I think, concerned about, as am I. Maybe we could start with Iran. What's your take on what's happening in the negotiations with Iran and the advisability of the deal that seems to be emerging?
Well, we're past the deadline, as you know, so the self-imposed deadline of June 30th has already been blown through. It seems to me that we're still pretty far away from any agreement that would be considered to be a good deal by those of us who care about this largest state sponsor of terror getting a nuclear capability, being legitimized by the leader of the free world, and be able to continue to be an existential threat to our strong ally Israel. So, you know, we've passed the legislation in the House and the Senate with the veto-proof vote that allows us to give an up or down vote to the final deal with some other restrictions involved. And if they go past July 9th for their final agreement, then we will actually have 30 additional days to review and put the brakes on any bad deal. And I'm of the view that no deal is better than a bad deal. And it seems like from what we've seen out of the framework and the reports of the negotiations, that there's still several very concerning elements to the concessions that the administration has made with their myopic approach that they've just got to get any deal. So, you know, I've had 6 combat deployments and, you know, a couple master's degrees involved with national security. So I've been studying this issue in this region my whole 26 years in the military. And so I've been a strong, loud voice making sure that we have the strength to wrote down a bad deal. I read a letter that we wrote from the Arizona delegation, bipartisan, 8 of 9 of us signed it to the Speaker and Pelosi to make sure that they understood where we are at related to what constitutes a good deal and a bad deal. And we can walk through some of those issues if you'd like to. But I'm deeply concerned that the President is wanting to do whatever it takes to get a deal. At the same time, by the way, not looking strategically at the larger issues in the Middle East and Iran's role of the blood that they have on their hands of American soldiers and others through their proxy wars, through Hezbollah, Hamas, and you know, the Quds Force, and all that they continue to do as a state sponsor of terror, somehow being dismissed as they are working to, you know, have some sort of legacy item in Obama's failed foreign policy.
Your colleague, Congressman Trent Franks, also from Arizona, has made the point that the Iranians have apparently adopted a doctrine which calls for the use of electromagnetic pulse against our electric grid. And that would, as you know, constitute an existential threat to the United States as well as to Israel. Is that of concern to you as well?
Oh, absolutely. And yeah, none of this obviously is discussed in the deal as well. So yeah, absolutely. I this is a potentiality that is, you know, some people think low probability, but certainly high risk. And if that's a part of their doctrine, that actually could be a devastating blow to us as a nation as well.
Let me switch gears, and we could spend days talking about this, and I hope we will in the future have a further conversation with you about the Iran piece, but your approach seems just right to me. How about this effort to degrade and defeat, as the president calls it, the Islamic State? Two of our colleagues in the Wall Street Journal today, Hillel Fredkin and Scooter Libby, talk about this as a phony war. You've been in real wars. I wonder, especially as an accomplished Air Force pilot, what you make of the kinds of strikes we've been conducting to date against the Islamic State. Does it really amount to basically phony war?
Oh, you know, absolutely. I have been very critical of the administration and their failed strategy and how they're using air power in a gradualistic and pinprick sort of way since they started strikes a year ago. And again, the false choices that they tend to create, which is it's either air power, which appears to be not working, or it's, you know, send a quarter million Americans on the ground, which we don't want to do. So we have this sort of false choice of boots on the ground versus air power. And because of the failed way that they're using air power, it's making people think like, well, I guess air power doesn't work. But the reality is that from the very beginning, we had the opportunity to defeat and destroy their command and control, their logistics capabilities, their some of the ways that they're getting resources while they're out in the open, some of their military capabilities. And even now, we are using a gradualistic approach that reminds me of Rolling Thunder in Vietnam that just doesn't work. And we are doing minimal strikes. We have legitimate targets that we are not hitting because of concern for maybe, you know, one civilian casualty might happen. And look, we don't want civilian casualties. I get that that could turn an entire, you know, village against us. But, you know, the laws of armed conflict are very clear. I've been involved in the targeting process from, you know, being a wingman in the A-10, a squadron commander, and then all the way up to at the combatant command level, running our targeting cell for Africa Command. I understand this process. We want to minimize civilian casualties. Of course, we don't target civilians. We do everything we can, whether it's, you know, vary our run-in headings or delay fuses and all sorts of things in order to minimize civilian casualties. But the thought that we would come off a legitimate target and not hit it and therefore embolden ISIS to murder hundreds and thousands more civilians because we want to make sure we, you know, don't have one, you know, civilian casualty while we're hitting a legitimate target is just ridiculous. And so I've been very critical, you know, really cornered the chairman of the Joint Chiefs and the Secretary of Defense last week in an Armed Services Committee hearing about this. So, you know, I've written about it and been speaking about it on national television. We have vital national interests at stake here, and we are hoping that, you know, somehow the Iran-backed Shia government in Iraq is going to be inclusive of Sunnis and get them to fight or have Shias fighting in Sunni territories and hoping it all works out. Hope is not a strategy. And we're acting like we're Air Force supporting their ground force as opposed to, you know, fighting for America's vital national interest to destroy and defeat them and create the space for, you know, a political solution. But now it looks like ISIS is taking on America and winning, which adds to their recruiting and the foreign fighter flow and all the things that show that they have the momentum and not us.
Congresswoman, let me just ask you very quickly, and we only have about a minute left, but it is important. Your experience in the military has been extraordinary. And yet I find myself in disagreement about one point in what you're doing in Congress, and that is on, as I understand it, championing this idea that women should serve not only in combat roles like you have, but also in ground combat positions. Would you just explain why you think that's a good idea and whether, if it does involve reducing the standards for our military personnel, men specifically, that might actually prove counterproductive to good combat operations capability?
Yeah, it has never been against the law for women to be in ground combat, first of all. It was only against the law for women to be in the air and in the sea in combat. So this has always been a policy, and the policy has changed. But look, this is about the best fighting force, and my advocacy is we got to pick the best man for the job, even if it's a woman, no matter what the job is. Let's set the standards, which includes physical plus aptitude plus leadership plus all sorts of other things we need in our fighting force, and let's pick the best person. The fact that we would say women can't do this and all men can means, you know, by virtue of that, you know, Serena Williams is not capable, but Justin Bieber is. That's ridiculous. This is about America. We are individuals. We are meritocratic. We have in the past lowered standards of criminal records and high school graduation and aptitude tests in order to fill the Army in 2005, 2006, 2007 timeframe. So, you know, we've lowered standards in the past, but we don't need to lower standards. We need to keep standards that are based on the warfighting jobs, and then we need to let people compete and pick the best people for the job. That's my perspective. This is about the best fighting force.
This is a subject I hope for a longer conversation again soon. Thank you very much for taking the time to be with us today. Congressman McSally of Arizona, it's great to talk with you, and I hope you'll continue serving your country as you are and have done now for so long, for so well. Keep it up. Talk to us soon. Mauricio Clavier Caron joins us. A bad deal in Iran, bad deal in Cuba. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Over the past decade, while the American military and intelligence community have been engaged in a kinetic war overseas against a wide array of enemies aligned with the global jihadist movement, the Center for Security Policy has consistently shed light upon a dark and subversive effort that thrives nearly unopposed right here in this country, the one known by the Muslim Brotherhood as Civilization Jihad. In an effort to educate freedom-loving Americans about Civilization Jihad and how it has been waged against every facet of American civilization, the Center for Security Policy has, in 2015, begun publishing a series of monographs called the Civilization Jihad Reader Series. The first of these monographs is entitled Sharia in American Courts, and it documents how Sharia, divine Islamic law, which animates the global jihadist movement, has entered our very own court system. In this study, the center documents how parties to litigation in American appellate courts have attempted to use Sharia to resolve 146 cases in 32 different states, potentially threatening the constitutional rights of our citizens, particularly women and children. The monograph not only highlights these cases, but the organizations here in America that are actively and successfully working to insinuate Sharia into our judiciary. Finally, it provides information on at least one antidote to this infirmity, a law that has been adopted in 8 states, one that protects our citizens against the use of foreign law and upholds our Constitution as the supreme law of the land, lest those who fight to defend our Constitution overseas do not come home to see it subordinated in a courtroom in their own home state. Learn more by reading Sharia in American Courts, which can be found on Amazon.com or the Center for Security Policy's website at www.securefreedom.org.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm Jared Ogden, former Navy SEAL and member of Team Military on National Geographic Channel's Ultimate Survival Alaska. I want to tell you about an issue that you probably haven't heard much about. Thousands of America's veterans are suffering from occupational and environmental exposures that they were exposed to while serving in the military. We call these the toxic wounds of war, from Agent Orange and Gulf War illness to post-9/11 burn pit exposure and heavy metals in the air, and other toxic exposures that we don't fully understand. The Sergeant Sullivan Center is a powerful voice in our nation's capital, standing watch over these forgotten wounded. These men and women can't do it alone, and they need your help today. Every dollar raised by Sergeant Sullivan Center goes to medical research, public awareness, and advocacy. You can make a tax-deductible donation today at www.sergeantsullivancenter.org. That's SGTSullivanCenter.org.
This is Frank Effney. You're listening to AM 1260, The Answer.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're joined by Mauricio Clavier Caron. He is a man active in Cuban-American affairs in a number of different capacities. He is, well, for example, the editor of a terrific blog, Capitol Hill Cubans, the host of the foreign policy show on SiriusXM's Christina
radio network entitled From Washington al Mundo. He's also the executive director of Cuba Democracy Advocates and always a welcome guest here at Secure Freedom Radio. Mauricio, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
Well, we have this unhappy development for those of us who have sought a free Cuba and a consistent and sensible American policy towards that end, of the announcement yesterday that we are going to open embassies in Havana and Washington, respectively. What does this portend? And more to the point, Mauricio, what is it that we've gotten for allowing the Cubans this very important new opening to our country?
Well, to answer the second first, absolutely nothing. We've gotten absolutely nothing in return. It's been completely one-sided negotiations. Actually, the Washington Post just wrote an editorial in which it mentions that more and more, this seems like a one-sided deal, and it's more than transparent in that regards. I think first and foremost, we have to recognize that this is the establishment of diplomatic relations with the only, and I like to highlight the only country in the Western Hemisphere not elected by its citizens. And that's important from a geopolitical perspective and what our interests are in the Western Hemisphere, which should be primarily democracy, human rights, free trade, commerce, etc. Allow this anomaly to recognize it unconditionally sends a horrible message to other regimes and other governments and other wannabe authoritarians in the region that want to take similar steps to the Castros, whether it's Maduro in Venezuela, Correa in Ecuador, or others. So it's a very dangerous message to send in that regard. In regards to the negotiations, it sends a dangerous message to the world. You know, whether it's Iran right now and our negotiations there, or whether it's dealings or troubles that we're having with Russia or others, it sends a dangerous message that this administration could negotiate for nothing. I mean, it's very simple. The president said this is what change looks like. Well, essentially what change looked like for him was essentially doing what any of presidents before him had been unwilling to do, which was give away everything for nothing.
And Mauricio, you have been very clear about the kinds of changes that the president is pursuing here. Give us a sense of what they are translating into in terms of, well, political legitimacy on the one hand, and, well, I guess life support for the Cuban regime as well.
Yeah, at a time that the Cuban regime was losing its lifeline of oil subsidies from Venezuela. Remember, this is a country that has essentially a parasitic state that has survived first from the Soviet Union and then after from Venezuelan oil subsidies. Here comes the Obama administration to give it political legitimacy and rescue it economically at its waning days. You know, the administration likes to say, hey, we have a failed policy towards Cuba. But the fact is, a politically, economically, and socially bankrupt regime is a pretty successful policy to me. I mean, what do we want to do? Because we need to have, you know, engagement is going to do better. Well, do we want to create a lucrative dictatorship like in China or another lucrative dictatorship like in Vietnam? It seems to me that this is actually a good model. To have this bankrupt dictatorship is exactly what we want. Meanwhile, since the president's announcement, all of a sudden Raul Castro, for the first time ever, is one of Time Magazine's 100 most influential people. So it goes to show you where this is going. By the way, in particularly distasteful move, this week's normalization announcement that took place while 226 peaceful pro-democracy, pro-American activists, Cuban activists on the island were violently arrested, half of those women known as the Ladies in White, and that was completely disregarded in the president's announcement. It's been completely disregarded by his administration thus far, once again falling on the wrong side when we should be on the side of those courageous democracy activists, our allies, our friends that are fighting for the freedom of all Cubans. Instead, the administration is embracing an 85-year-old dictator.
Yeah, and Mauricio, what you've just said, and I think it's so important, let me just emphasize it, is on the one hand, the negotiations, as elsewhere, notably in Iran, are one-sided and are simply providing all manner of life support to an odious regime that is not worthy of it. But secondly, it is emboldening that regime, and probably a lot of others besides, to behave even more badly. I mean, rolling up these women in white and allowing that to go unchallenged, unremarked even, is a travesty for the United States. And I find it unspeakable. I'm sure you do too. Let me just ask you about one other piece of this, because I think that
greasing the skids, as always in these matters, is the idea that there's some giant economic bonanza for American companies in Cuba. It's been pointed out by one of our other guests, Jose Cardenas, that the place is bankrupt as a practical matter. The only way that there's going to be business done there is when American taxpayers are obliged to basically underwrite it. Is that your view as well, Mauricio Claver Corón?
Which goes to show also the nonsense of all this. You know, the only way that American companies are going to make money in Cuba is if American taxpayers begin to finance the regime and if American tourists begin to finance the regime. So in other words, the American companies that are interested in going down there are essentially wanting to count on Americans themselves, but being funneled through a anti-American dictatorship 90 miles away, which is complete nonsense. I want to make a really important point, Frank, also to remember in what you just mentioned. This entire policy began from the hostage taking of Alan Gross, the man who was taken in December 2009 hostage. And these were conditions that the regime has been wanting all along. And as you know better than anyone else, you know, any policy that stems from coercion and hostage taking is not in American interest. And it's the same thing that we've been seeing in Iran. I saw, you know, that we found out that in 2009 there was some other prisoners that was exchanged and things of the sort in regards to Iran. Other rogue regimes are learning the message that taking American hostages works, and Cuba is Exhibit A in that policy.
Mauricio, let me ask you about another piece of this. I alluded to it earlier. The Cubans, as this is going forward, have been intensifying their relationships with the Russians and Chinese in ways, again, that could have very ominous strategic implications for the United States. Give us a flavor of what's afoot there.
So there were four rounds of negotiations with the United States in order to lead to this diplomatic relations announcement. And in the two rounds of negotiations that took place in Havana, by mere coincidence, I guess, an infamous Russian spy ship was docked in the port of Havana twice at that time. So therefore, there's obviously not good intentions on the Cuban side, welcoming, on the one hand, supposedly the United States for these negotiations, and then for the Russians to dock their spy ships 90 miles from our shores. And those spy ships, as you know, are very sophisticated, are able to intercept our communications. Let's not forget that in Florida, you have both the Southern Command of the United States Armed Forces and the Central Command in Tampa. And therefore, why also the electronic espionage base of Lourdes, which is outside of Havana, which was a Soviet communications signal base for a long time. There's a lot of talk and there's a lot of kind of crosstalk in Russia by different officials saying that it is going to become active again and the Russians are going to be paying for it. As you well know, the Russians have canceled a huge sum of Cuba debt. I'm sure that was not for nothing. I'm sure there's something in exchange there. And a lot of it indicates that that spy signals base might be reactivated and they'll have a presence there, which is very much a danger to our interests.
Yeah, indeed. It's my understanding that at least in the old days, and presumably with the improvements that they'll be making, perhaps with help from the Chinese, this facility will be able to capture not only the signals out of Tampa, as you've mentioned, but the entire eastern seaboard and much of the middle of the United States as well. This is a profound threat to the country, I believe, as well as we'll probably find with a nest of spies operating out of the Cuban embassy when it is open. We look forward to the fight over this, and I'm quite confident you will be in the midst of it. Mauricio Claver Corón, thank you, among other things, for your terrific work at Capitol Hill Cubans, the blog, and also on Sirius. Come back to us again very soon, if you would.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. On Tuesday, the State Department finally coughed up another batch of former Secretary Hillary Clinton's emails that had been withheld until Judicial Watch obtained a court order compelling their release. The correspondence confirms what has long been suspected. The Clinton team in Foggy Bottom was complicit in a White House-led effort to perpetrate a fraud on the American people. It involved the assertion that a U.S.-based filmmaker's video precipitated the murderous jihadist attack in Benghazi in 2012. The fraud was meant not only to deflect attention from the administration's myriad policy failures in Libya, it also served to advance the Obama-Clinton gang's long-term collaboration with the Muslim supremacist Organization of Islamic Cooperation, aimed at restricting our freedom of expression. There must be accountability both for the fraud and the Obama-Clinton administration's policy debacles. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
There are many sounds in your daily life. Ones that make you smile. Ones that help you relax. And there are some sounds that can help save lives. Wireless emergency alerts, now on many mobile devices, use a unique sound and vibration to bring you critical information about emergencies in your area. With updates from local sources you know and trust, you can be in the know wherever you are. Learn more at ready.gov/alerts. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
Secure Freedom announces the launch of our newest initiative, the Counter Jihad Campaign, at counterjihad.com. We have gathered some of the foremost experts and activists to begin our fight back against those who long ago declared war on us. You can see our first two ads asking those who see something bad happening, like the attack in Garland, Texas, or the dozen jihadists at the Boston Marathon Killers Mosque, to say something. Join us and be a part of the Counter Jihad.
When we decided to rename this radio station, we came up with one word, one very big word, answer. That's because we know our listeners better than anybody. We know you wake up every day with an insatiable appetite for news and information. But more than that, you want to know what to make of it all. That's why we're here. Do this better than any station in town. Welcome aboard. AM 1260, The Answer.
I'm Fred Fleitz with the Center for Security Policy. At the G7 summit in Germany this week, President Obama said this about his strategy to take on ISIS in Iraq.
When a finalized plan is presented to me by the Pentagon, then I will share it with the American people. We don't yet have a complete strategy.
How can President Obama in June 2015 still not have a plan to deal with ISIS in Iraq? After all, he also said this in August 2014. The truth is the president does have a strategy to deal with ISIS in Iraq and Syria. It's to put significant restrictions on U.S. troops and to do as little as possible so he can say he's a president who got the United States out of wars, not into one. Ultimately, the president wants to hand this mess to the next president. I'm Fred Fleitz. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We're joined by Fred Fleitz, my colleague at the Center for Security Policy, our Senior Vice President for Policy and Programs, a career intelligence professional with some 20 years of service at the Central Intelligence Agency. Also, he served as John Bolton's Chief of Staff at the State Department and as a professional staff member of the House Intelligence Committee. Always a welcome guest here as well. Fred, welcome back.
Good to be here, Frank.
Well, it's Iran all the time around here, I think, at the moment. We haven't spoken, Fred, since the president decided that the deadline of the end of June wasn't a deadline after all. Not a surprise exactly, but where do you think things stand at the moment?
Well, not surprisingly, it looks like Iran is trying to push for as many concessions as possible in a final deal, assuming it really wants a final deal. I mean, most of us didn't think the deadline would be reached. The latest we're hearing is that the administration is hoping for an agreement by July 7th. If it gets an agreement by July 9th, Congress only gets 30 days to review the deal. After July 9th, it gets 60 days. And as we've been talking, this review would give Congress the ability to pass a resolution of disapproval, which the president could veto. It falls far short of the constitutional requirements for a treaty under which the Senate would need to ratify a treaty by 2/3. There's some significant outstanding issues that we're aware of. I guess the most troubling concerns inspections. The administration said this would have the most robust and intrusive inspections in history, but we're hearing now that there may be something called managed inspections of some military facilities, and the administration is saying, well, the U.S. would never agree to inspections of all military facilities
in any agreement it's signed, which actually isn't true. We have had managed inspections of our military facilities by the Russians, including the Russians being able to get near our nuclear weapons. There were restrictions on these facilities. But under this deal, the Iranians would not let inspectors into certain facilities at all, which means they can't take soil samples and swipes to see where the nuclear activities have been taking place.
Fred, just so we're clear, the International Atomic Energy Agency would be the mechanism for conducting these sorts of inspections, as I understand it. This is a rather big role for a group that has a somewhat checkered record. That record may have gotten a little bit more checkered just today. I understand there's a new report from the IAEA about Iranian conduct. What do we know about it, and what does it suggest we can expect from them in the role that they might be playing in this inspection of this agreement, should it come to pass?
I was discussing this with a former senior U.S. official yesterday. He expressed concern that the IAEA is about to come out with a report giving Iran a clean bill of health. Now, a report came out today. It's a monthly report on Iran's compliance with the 2013 interim agreement, which began the talks. And it says that Iran is in compliance with reducing its enriched uranium under a 2013 interim agreement mandate. Now, some of the media are saying, well, this shows Iran is in compliance with what it agreed to when the talks began. But, I mean, that's not the way I read this, and it's not the way Omni Saren reads it either. This simply shows that Iran has reduced its enriched uranium to uranium powder, uranium oxide. This is simply a form of enriched uranium that can be put back into a form that can be made into weapons grade in about 2 weeks. It's not a significant achievement. So basically, they're using a very, very low threshold to measure Iranian compliance with the interim agreement. I don't think this means Iran is in compliance.
And more to the point, Fred Flights, and you have written about this extensively at National Review and elsewhere. You've been commenting about it at Fox and elsewhere. You have, I think, properly called to mind the extent to which the Iranians may have a secret parallel program underway, and that any calculations, let alone representations now being made by the IAEA or the Obama administration for that matter or others, presumably does not take into account what might be going on in those secret facilities and the activities that they're supporting. John Kerry said something to the effect that, you know, we know everything about what's going on in Iran. In your professional judgment as a career intelligence guy, is that so?
Well, I know that isn't so, Frank. There are many enigma sites in Iran that may or may not be related to nuclear activity. U.S. officials simply don't know what's going on there. This was the case with the Fordo enrichment facility, which the Iranians revealed in the late 2000s. It is an underground enrichment plant built into the side of a mountain, so it can't be destroyed by airstrikes. The U.S. knew something was going on there, but didn't confirm what it was for many years. Actually, didn't confirm until the NCRI, an Iranian opposition group, revealed it. This has been the case repeatedly with every Iranian facility. It's been the case in North Korea. We clearly do not know everything about Iran's nuclear program.
Which just raises, again, the question about the value of this deal, especially if we're not going to be allowed to go into places that we detect or suspect of having such activities underway, let alone any kind of real baseline for what has been going on prior to this. And this is another of the concessions, as I understand it, Fred Flights, that have been made by the Obama administration, that the so-called previous military dimensions of the Iranian program are no longer things that we're going to have to get hammered out and some sort of agreed understanding about, which, again, just raises the question, Fred, and I think you've been very clear about this, but say it again. What does this deal mean for a nuclear capability, a nuclear weapons capability in the hands of the most dangerous regime, arguably, on the planet?
I think it's clear that Iran will not just continue its pursuit of nuclear weapons, but the timetable to an Iranian nuclear bomb will be shortened during this deal, because Iran will continue to enrich uranium and will continue to build advanced uranium centrifuges during the deal. Now, there's a letter being circulated with the Mears Institute for Middle East Policy. It's a bipartisan letter. Got a lot of press play. These guys, for criticize administration nuclear talks. But this letter says steps have to be taken to restrict Iran's development of advanced centrifuges. Frank, Iran shouldn't be enriching uranium at all. It has no need for it. Given the fact that it's repeatedly broken its nuclear treaties, this is a technology Iran cannot be trusted with. That's our standard when we share nuclear technology with many of our friends and allies. It's inconceivable we wouldn't hold this standard to a treaty concerning nuclear technology with Iran.
Yeah, or an agreement. If it's not a treaty, nonetheless, has the effect of it. Fred, given what you've said, what is your current reading on the likelihood that Congress will exercise a serious sort of quality control role on this agreement? The president himself said that if it doesn't close all of the pathways to a bomb and it isn't adequately verifiable, there should be no deal. That would seem to be the sentiment of many people in Congress. Do you think that Congress will rise to this challenge? And what sense of timing do you have on it?
Well, the president made that statement last week. We've long since passed that requirement. I mean, that simply is an untrue statement. I think there's going to be enough votes to reject the deal right now. But we shouldn't underestimate the celebration in the news media that's going to result when the administration and Western governments praise this historic deal for restricting Iran's nuclear program when it doesn't. I'm worried some members of Congress will be susceptible to that. That's why the Center for Security Policy, using our program, IranTruth.org, go to our website, IranTruth.org. We're trying to educate the American people and the U.S. Congress about the dangers of this deal.
Yeah, well, your leadership in that regard is really appreciated. We're especially proud of the work that you and others with us have helped fashion in the form of the so-called National Security 9 red lines, for want of a better term, that we think would mark an acceptable deal with Iran, and that unfortunately we seem to be well shy of, to say the least, in terms of the present negotiations. I know you'll be following them closely, Fred. We look forward to visiting with you next week about it. In the meantime, I hope you have a good 4th of July weekend, and thanks for all the work that you're providing and leadership on this very, very important topic. Next up, we'll be speaking with Chris Farrell of Judicial Watch about a new trove of emails implicating Hillary Clinton in national security fraud, as well as probably violations of the law. That and more, straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
It's been over 7 years since a church group from another state brought a couple hundred refugees to the rural county where I live. I wanted to know, how could they do this? What was the governmental process that allowed the resettlement of refugees to a county ill-prepared to assimilate them? Employment opportunities were scarce. The health department was not familiar with illnesses and mental health problems of people who came from parts of the third world. The school system was not prepared to teach large numbers of students who didn't speak English.
That's author Ann Corcoran discussing her new book, Federal Immigration Policy, Resettlement and the Hijra to America. She explains how Muslim immigrants are being quietly resettled into American towns without vetting them, even for terrorist links. Corcoran also explains how the global jihad movement is using immigration as a stealth campaign to spread its influence in America. You can read Federal Immigration Policy, Resettlement, and the Hijra to America on securefreedom.org or purchase a copy on amazon.com.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm Robert Muse, co-founder and senior counsel of the American Freedom Law Center, our nation's premier public interest law firm fighting for your faith and freedom in courtrooms across America. Make no mistake, we live in a pivotal time. Secular progressives such as Barack Obama and his surrogates are zealously sweeping religion from the public square, foisting Sharia law and other harmful international precedents into our courts and constitution, assaulting the traditional family, and weakening our national defense by, among other things, undermining the strength of our military through social engineering and political correctness. But I can assure you that the American Freedom Law Center is aggressively engaging our nation's enemies with offensive lawfare to defend our fundamental rights and to fight stealth jihad in all of its forms, including the civilization jihad being waged by Muslim Brotherhood front groups operating here in the U.S. Indeed, there is no other public interest law firm as uniquely qualified to fight this battle. But we need your prayers and financial support to succeed. Please consider a tax-deductible donation to support our critical fight for your faith and freedom. Visit us at www.AmericanFreedomLawCenter.org.
I'm Fred Fleitch with the Center for Security Policy. One of President Obama's worst foreign policy failings is the lack of a strategy to defeat Al-Qaeda and ISIS. These terrorist groups are part of a global movement to establish Islamic supremacy and Sharia through violence. This movement is called the Global Jihad Movement. It will not be defeated without a strategy that recognizes its true nature. In January 2015, we issued a comprehensive strategy to defeat the global jihad movement. It is called the Secure Freedom Strategy and is based on National Security Directive 75, the strategy that President Ronald Reagan used to defeat the global totalitarian threat of his time, the Soviet Union. Like President Reagan's strategy, we lay out a comprehensive plan on how the United States government can be reorganized and focused to understand and defeat the global jihad movement. You can read the Secure Freedom Strategy at securefreedom.org, or you can purchase a copy on Amazon.com. I'm Fred Fleitz.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
Annie Soldier Incorporated was started in August 2003 as a simple family effort to help the soldiers in one Army unit, thus the name. However, due to overwhelming requests, on January 1, 2004, the Annie Soldier effort was expanded so it would include any member of any of the armed services in harm's way. Won't you please help? Find out how by going to www.anysoldier.com today.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. I'm very pleased to say, joined by one of our most favored guests, a man who has done incalculably important work, both in uniform as a military intelligence officer in the United States Army, and currently, in his present incarnation, as the Director of Investigations and Research at a simply indispensable organization, Judicial Watch. He is, of course, Chris Farrell. And, Chris, I'm very pleased to have you back, especially in light of the latest achievements of your efforts, notably in the Freedom of Information Act, or FOIA area, concerning Hillary Clinton's emails and what they're shedding new light on about, well, among other things, the Benghazi Gate scandal. Welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thank you, Frank. Great to be on with you.
So what do you make of the latest trove that you managed to extricate from the administration, I guess through court order at the moment? Is that right?
It is correct, by court order, because we've had to file lawsuits to compel the State Department and the administration generally to produce the records to us they've been hiding now for years. And they know they've been hiding them because there's evidence documented now that Hillary's email and her separate unlawful account that she established on the day, I think it's 2 days after she was actually confirmed as Secretary of State, they knew going into office that she was going to lie and try to obscure and withhold these records from public accountability. And so now, years later, a federal judge is ordering them to be produced. And what they show is an orchestrated White House political operation aimed at not only protecting Hillary and her objectives, but also the administration's failure in Benghazi. And this is all documented in an additional 3,000 pages of emails, and it shows them synchronizing their strategy. And it's not one of trying to preserve national security. It's one of trying to preserve political legacy. It's very clear.
This requires not only some intrepid investigative work on your part to get access to this this particular batch of emails and the others that you're also trying to secure, but Chris Farrell, you're forced to make sort of sense of what have been redacted from these documents as well. Is that right?
Yeah, and then of course, what's most interesting is that there are redactions now claiming that it's classified information, which runs 180 degrees opposite of what Hillary claimed when she released some pages of her email, saying that she never, use of the word never is important here, that she never sent any classified information via the email that we're now examining, which is in fact classified, or at least the administration claims that it is. Now the question there is it legitimately classified, or is it classified for political purposes to continue to perpetuate the cover-up they're involved in?
Let me just digress for a second. By training, you were a military intelligence officer, Chris, in a previous life. We've discussed this before, but again, in light of what you've just said, the administration is now on record in front of a federal judge indicating that Hillary Clinton had on her private server in her home unsecured classified information. Am I getting that right?
That is correct. And in fact, there is a National Security Agency, an NSA directive on what they refer to as spillage, which has to do with, gee, oops, I didn't mean to send that classified email on my unclassified network. What do I do now? And it happens, legitimately happens. There are, you know, people make errors, right? And so there's an NSA directive from a committee at the NSA that deals with national security systems that says if there's even any doubt that there was some mistake, some error, that all of the email from that particular addressee or server should be treated as classified and should be reviewed, and not what Hillary has done, which is this sort of self-serving, self-selective, oh, we're going to release some, oh, my attorney said we're not going to release these. She does not enjoy that privilege. She's operating outside the law and has been for years.
Well, this is really the crux of the matter. And again, at Judicial Watch, you guys are all about the law. You are working closely with federal courts to try to ensure compliance with the law, not just the Freedom of Information Act law, but others that you uncover wrongdoing concerning in the course of your FOIA efforts. And Chris Farrell, let me just again put this to you. We're told, as I understand it, that Huma Abedin, a rather colorful character, to say the least, a woman who has been associated by, among others, our own organization, the Center for Security Policy, Andy McCarthy, National Review Online, and so on, with the Muslim Brotherhood, was evidently among those responsible for selecting which of these emails Hillary Clinton gave over to the federal government, some of which you're now getting access to, and some of which were simply destroyed. Again, Chris, does this constitute, in your estimation, illegal activity?
It does. Look, Huma Abedin has major, major unresolved counterintelligence issues pertaining to her, her familial connections, her work arrangement, where she was essentially crescent lighting or moonlighting in a very peculiar special employment arrangement, where she left government service as a straight-up employee and became what they call a special government employee, with her outside consulting arrangements while serving as deputy chief of staff to the Secretary of State. This is mind-boggling that you'd have anybody with these family connections and these outside business interests in the inner circle of the Secretary's office. I can't imagine a more conflicted counterintelligence issue with respect to her personally and professionally. It's a nightmare.
And again, this is an area in which you specialized in the United States military. So your professional assessment of this, I think, has considerable weight. Let me turn quickly, Chris. We're going to run out of time here. But Huma Abedin features in the email traffic that you have just uncovered in connection with the Benghazi damage control operation. There seem to be two pieces to this, as best I can tell. One is in cahoots with Ben Rhodes, the deputy national security advisor to the president, trying to conceal the policy failures you said earlier in connection with Benghazi, but it's actually policy failures with respect to Libya and, well, for that matter, the Muslim Brotherhood and a lot more besides. But Chris, there's also this meme that the Huma Abedins and the Rashid Husseins, the president's special envoy to the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, were engaged in as well, that seem to have as its core focus trying to suppress our freedom of expression. Talk about that, if you would, please.
Yeah, there's this synchronized effort out of the White House to kind of phony up or generate this false narrative about what was going on, the so-called Arab Spring more broadly, but even narrowly down into Benghazi and Libya. That, you know, there's this effort, again, by Abedin, by Hussein, in an effort to sort of constrain or construct this narrative about cooperation, about how we're going to explain away what happened in Benghazi and in Libya more broadly. It is a sinister nexus, in my opinion, of operatives who have an agenda that I don't think is consistent with. And again, it raises these same counterintelligence issues with respect to who are they really working for.
It goes without saying that they wouldn't be doing all of this without the authorization, the approval, the assent, the cooperation, indeed the participation of the President of the United States and the Secretary of State at the time, Hillary Clinton. And I guess what we're saying, Chris, is these people are all complicit, not just those who have ties to the Muslim Brotherhood like Huma Abedin and Rashid Husseins, but our president and our then Secretary of State with this effort to suppress our freedom of expression through not just this Benghazi Gate cover-up, but also the Istanbul process and much more besides. Chris, I just have to say, I cannot tell you the full extent of my own appreciation, and I think of that of our listeners and Americans across this country for the work you guys do at Judicial Watch. I hope you will keep it up, of course, and come back to us with regularity. And for that matter, I hope the rest of you will come back to us for more. Same time, same station, tomorrow. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.